everyone, and welcome to Palestine Exists, a space where we deep dive into all things Palestine, from history and politics to culture, resistance, and the stories that deserve to be told. If you've ever felt overwhelmed by the headlines, frustrated by misinformation, or just eager to learn more about Palestine beyond the mainstream narrative, this is the place for you. As always, hey y'all, I'm Petra, and we have Hiba here. Hi, Habuba.
Hi, Patura. How are you?
I'm sick. I'm going through it, bro. And this is the reason, like, by my voice, right? I hope everyone can tell why we missed the episode last week. I'm so sorry. I've been out of it for, like, the past few, 4 weeks?
No, it's
been my fault. I'm so sorry, but
I'll literally beat your ass.
Ugh, I love you. But yeah, like, I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to talk to you.
I miss you so much. Well, like, let's catch up real quick. This is a big week. Like, the last 2 weeks, it's been like, I don't know. I don't say this often, but it's been a good week to be Palestinian. Okay. First, Iran. W. Always W fucking Iran.
Iran, bro. W.
Literally. And then you. And then Hoda from Love Island.
Ugh, I love her. Whoever makes fun of her is just anti-Palestinian at this point. I do not care.
You know how I've been going and like having these like propaganda and like not propaganda, but like literally fighting for my life defending her.
I love
this
her.
Past week. But like I said, it's been a good week to be Palestinian. I don't know. Huda's in the villa. Bitches are trying to vote her out, but the bitch is still in.
Palestinian queen.
Palestinian. Look at her. She said, I'm stayed here. I'm like, she said, Samud where? Samud in this villa. Literally. And then fucking Iran's like, don't worry, queen. We got Tel Aviv covered. You go do your thing in Fiji.
Oh my God.
Fiji.
And girl, she's in like Fiji. They don't have access to any of the shit. Bro. So she's going to walk out and be like, what the fuck?
You know how like mad I got on social media? Because like, bro, I don't even use like, I saw Huda hate on Threads. Threads, Petra. Who the fuck uses Threads?
I don't know.
But it pissed me the fuck off. I joined a fucking Instagram pro Huda group chat or whatever. There's like over 100 people in it. And I was like, you guys, like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm not trying to be like that girl. But like, where'd it go? I was like, not to be like that person or whatever. But can we speak about how all these fucking pro-Israeli accounts... are also posting like anti-Huda hate? Are these not are these not connected? Is it just a coincidence that Alex Earl, the bitch who fucking just like literally got dropped for being genocidal, is now like jumping on this anti-Huda train?
I don't like Huda.
Weird.
Like, fuck all of y'all, bro. Huda, we've always been a fan. Like, fuck all those fake bitches. Come to us, BB. We love you.
She's never gonna listen to this, but bitch, we love you.
She will.
Like, I'm fighting for my life for you, but I will still do it. I giggled when you called him a pussy ass bitch. Like, you should have done it more. You should have doubled down, tripled down, actually. But anyways, and like, sorry.
In other news, welcome back.
I just really had to talk about it because I was so frustrated.
So upset. Me too, bro.
Anyways, so imagine knowing that the land beneath your feet so intimately that it's rocks, it's trees, it's olive groves. They're not just places. They're anchors of your identity, extensions of your very body, right? And this is how Palestinians experienced our land, especially the Fallahin, who is the rural majority of our ancestors. The 1936 revolt was not a simple nationalist uprising, right? It was a desperate fight to hold onto life itself. And like, it was visceral and it was embodied and it was deeply personal for us, right?
100%.
For decades, British and Zionist policies systematically stripped peasants of their land, violently severing relationships between people, place, and even our memory, right? Mm-hmm. But here's the thing. When you threaten someone, when you threaten someone's connection to the earth beneath their feet, you threaten their very ontology, their very identity, right? Palestinian fallahin didn't rise up merely for political rights. They revolted to protect their very existence. Mm-hmm. And their resistance was existential. It was refusing to become ghosts on their own land. But I want to like clarify something crucial here, because I'm not trying to romanticize and I'm not trying to make it seem like this was like a romantic rebellion of like simple villagers, right? It was profoundly radical, precisely because it refused the colonizers' terms entirely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even like there's historians who've called it politics of refusal, right? Palestinians, we've rejected partition, autonomy, and colonial benevolence, right? Instead, we claim dignity outside of colonial frameworks. And we refuse to become perfect victims, right?
100%. Yeah.
We didn't like plead for external validation. Instead, Palestinians in 1936, we insisted on their right to our right to exist on our own terms. And so the resistance didn't come from above. It was deeply rooted in Palestinian consciousness, and it was a trauma and also like the trauma of displacement, right? It's not just about like losing land, it's about losing yourself. So the result of the revolt was a fight against erasure, right? Like just our erasure. And I don't know, I think today when you see Palestinians planting olive trees or stubbornly saying staying on their land, it's not just symbolic defiance, it's reclamation, it's ownership. And it echoes in the 1936 struggle. And it shows people we are not going anywhere, you know? It like powerfully asserted we're not going anywhere. And the British knew that, right? So they knew it wasn't about like isolated acts of violence or some scattered revolt. They knew what was building, right, was bigger than guns or raids. And what they saw, what they feared, was that the Palestinians were acting as we always do without permission. We weren't asking for reform. We weren't appealing to London. They were acting like they had the right to decide what their lives should look like. And we did, right? And this is what made this dangerous, right? Not just the attacks, not the strikes, but the fact that the people leading them had stopped waiting for the empire to respond. And what came out of that moment, was it clean? It was not clean or centralized. It didn't come with manifestos or organized platforms. It came through necessity, right? And it was formed through family, community, and it was for survival. And that's how the Fasa'il was formed, right?
Yeah.
And it was like small local rebel bands, and they were built through kinship, right? Fighters weren't recruited, and they were basically joined by people they already knew, and cousins, neighbors, sons, Ibn Ammik, right?
Yeah.
The resistance wasn't some external force. It was the people you prayed next to, the people who buried your uncle, and the people who lived in the same, you know, neighborhood and valley, and who knew the same fields that you tended to. And it worked. They knew the terrain. They knew how to disappear. They could strike and move and come back and strike again, right? The British couldn't control them the way that they controlled cities, and because they couldn't really regulate what they couldn't see. And I think what's important is the same things that made it powerful also made it fragile, right? Because when your resistance depends on tight-knit relationships, family, trust, community, shared values, those are the same exact things that can be turned against you, right? Or used against you. And that's what the British did. They didn't try to beat the rebellion. They tried to break the social bonds that made it possible. And resistance isn't abstract, right? It operated through real people, real fighters, and it was deeply tied to their villages and their families. And Petra's gonna break down how exactly these rebel units, which I just called the Fasa'il, operated on the ground, and also critically, also most importantly for Palestinian history and identity, how the British fractured them from within.
Yeah, 100%. So last episode, we talked about Sheikh Izzeddin al-Qassam and his rebel group. and the end of it, right? The Black Hand. So the death of Izzeddin al-Qassam is what really sparked and pushed a lot of these other, you know, decentralized groups to emerge. So after his death in November of 1935, we saw the outrage, right? Like, even at his funeral, we saw it. And then this is when Palestine itself erupted. This is where we would see these general strikes. And then from these general strikes, we would see the emerging of the armed rebel groups. So they emerged organically pretty much all across of Palestine. And it was in response to the British repression of political channels. There were so many political groups that were emerging from the 1930s up to then. And it was because every single time a group would emerge, they would either be canceled out or they would end up, you know, as quote unquote collaborators. And we'll discuss that a bit later. So just within this time frame, within, you know, 5-6 years, we had the Independence Party, which we spoke a bit about previously. Sheikh Izzeddin al-Qassam was not a member, but he did approve of what the Independence Party was doing. They were more peaceful and not really armed, and it was more of like the boycotting style. Then we have the Nashashbi, National Defense Party, which we'll discuss a bit later. We have the pro-Husseini, Palestinian Arab Party. We have the Khalidi Arab Palestinian Reform Party. We also have the national bloc that was based in Nablus. We have the emerging of, you know, the youth. We have the Young Men's Muslim Association. We have the Youth Congress Party, the Palestinian Boy Scout Movement. And my favorite, we have the women organizations, like the Arab Women's Congress. And it was led by an amazing woman called Tarab Abdul Hadi. She created a bunch of women associates, and they truly played a very key and an important role in the inter-village rallying and, you know, defending the rebellion, defending our rebel groups, like women usually do. WS.
WS always.
WS always. But yeah, so after Sheikh Izzeddin al-Qassam, we talked previously about it. There was a Qassasma cell, and they were named after the martyr. They led a lot of operations, but they were very small, and it wasn't fully organized. Then we would see these, you know, organically emerging rural Palestinian supporting these rebel groups. And in response to the British, they were mostly, or they were always, composed of the peasants, quote unquote, or falahi, rural villagers, nationalists, sometimes ex-policemen who saw right through and saw exactly what the Brits were doing. And we have, you know, some veterans as well. They were formed into very small groups. They were guerrilla groups, and they were very familiar with the local terrain. W indigeneity.
Always.
And the name Fasa'il is basically just, it just means bands. And, you know, each Fasa'il was led by a commander, which is in Arabic, in Arabic, it's Qa'ed al-Fasa'il, or the band leader. Again, very small groups, handful to several dozen fighters. And they, their operation tactics, they employed guerrilla warfare tactics. They did ambushes, sabotages, hit and run attacks. Pretty much what we see currently with our resistance groups, like Hamas, PFLP, PIJ, whatever else. They usually preferred nighttime operations just because of the minimal exposure, and because they're so knowledgeable of the geography, it didn't really matter if it was daytime. They targeted British military installations, police stations, British infrastructure, and as well as Zionist settlements. So their deployment, they initially operated without centralized coordination. So a group would do something there, a group would do there. They were like, every group would do whatever they wanted to do or whatever they planned to do. And it wasn't fully, you know, like coordinated with other groups. Because of this, over time, you know, we did see they started unifying under the operations and regional commands to enhance effectiveness, which makes sense. The notable commanders of the regions, we have three. So we have Abd al-Rahim al-Hajj Muhammad. Abd al-Rahim, he mainly operated in Wadi al-Sha'ar, which is areas between Nablus and the coastal plain. And he, you know, was known for organizing small mobile units that conducted attacks on specifically British forces. Then we have Yusuf Abu Durra. He was based near Haifa. So Yusuf didn't just oversee one band, he actually oversaw anywhere from 17 to 20 of the bands, and he had roughly 250 fighters under him. His operations, including confrontations with the local Druze community, because they had political tensions within them, and so they would go operate there, speak with them. And then we have Yusuf Hamdan, and he was basically the second in command to Abu Durra. He was recognized for leading more organized and disciplined rebel bands during the revolts. So this is like the overview of these fasa'ils. Obviously, the British response to this was, oh, these are terrorists, these are bandits. They refused to acknowledge any of their nationalistic motivations at all. The Brits implemented very, very harsh measures, mass arrests, executions. And this is the time where they used our people against us. This is where we see the peace bands emerging, or Fasa'il al-Salam. So last episode, I talked about this cute little family called the Nashashbi family. So they, al-Nashashbi family, had an organization, right? They were called the National Defense Party. They started during 1935, and they were very influential. This was when, you know, they were elites, they had the money, they were the city men, they had like founders and chairmen and all of this stuff. And Hajj Amin al-Husseini was actually a part of them before he broke out from them. And we'll, again, talk about this a bit later. But seeing the rebels, seeing al-Fasa'il fighting off the Brits, and then witnessing what the Brits responded to, then the Nashashbi family decided, this isn't going to work for us. And they went ahead and collaborated with the Brits. They broke off from, you know, working and helping with the Fasa'il, the rebel bands, and they created their own group called the Fasa'il al-Salam, or the Peace Bands. It was established around 1937, and they were comprised of Palestinian collaborators who did not like the way the rebels were going, or did not like the British response to them, because the Brits were like, nope, we're not going to give you anything, da 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 da. And at this point, they also opposed Husseini and what he believed should be, you know, done. They truly and honestly, from, you know, everything I've read, they wanted their own protection and their own personal gain. They were recruited by the Brits with promise of money, weapons, immunity, and local authority. Mm-hmm. So power, money, weapons, you throw that at them and they, you know, they automatically flipped and agreed with the Brits and created this. They acted as the local enforcers. So they would patrol the areas, arrest the rebels, and they anyone they suspected was a rebel or suspected was a sympathizer to these rebels, they would intimidate and, you know, tell them, oh, we're going to take you to the Brits. They're going to go hang you. They're going to whatever else. That was their tactic. And so all they did was work with the Brits to fight off the rebels and anyone who was, what, you know, like, no, I agree with the rebels. They also provided intelligence to the Brits about any movement of the rebels, any local support, any networking, anything that they would hear while patrolling, while listening, they would go and automatically tell the Brits about it. They did also engage in direct combat. Usually they would go and raid villages and then ambush the rebels or their supporters. They also assisted in psychological warfare because they instilled like the fear and mistrust among the population. So, you know, if you're a Palestinian with the rebels or, you know, you support the rebels, if you see these people, you're automatically going to get afraid. And you're it does cause mistrust. Like, hey, I thought we were all on the same boat. I thought we were all here to free ourselves from the Brits. And now we have these people working right. against us. And this truly and honestly contributed to the internal fracturing of the Palestinian society. And it also, in the same end, it deepened the tribal and political rifts as well. So that's a bit about these two. Again, the elite Palestinians, after the peace bands were created, we had, it was a divide. So we had the Husseinis, and this is why when I said like the, there was the pro-Husseini Palestinian Arab Party versus the pro-Nashashbi. This is where it all came from. So the Husseinis was led by Haj Amin al-Husseini, and he supported the revolts. He supported the rebels and eventually got exiled for it. And then we have the Nashashbis, who did not, you know, they did just did not cooperate right. with the Palestinians, did not want any of the revolts, did not want any of the rebels, and they cooperated with the Brits. And then eventually, and obviously, of course, Hiba's going to get into it a bit more, the Arab High Committee was eventually outlawed for these very specific reasons. Mm-hmm. And the Brits also, you know, to simmer down the Palestinians, not only did they collaborate with the Palestinians, they created their own special night squads. And it was led by Ord Wingate, who was a Zionist. And so everything we see in the West Bank currently, them coming at night and, you know, instilling the fear into Palestinians and all of this tactics, that's exactly what the special night squad did. They pioneered night raids, the tactics that, you know, would influence everything we see currently and all of the Zionist military strategies. And unfortunately, our people were a part of it.
So where Petra left off, we were knee deep in betrayal, right? Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about collapse, like Petra said, we need to talk about the Arab Higher Committee, not in passing, but what it actually was, right? The beginning of a leadership problem we still haven't solved, right?
Oh, 100%, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The committee was formed in 1936, as Petra spoke about, but it brought together the leading Palestinian factions under Haj Amin al-Husseini. On the surface, it was a show of unity, and in practice, it was fucked up from the start. The leadership was elite, urban, landed, right? The fighters, the ones who were actually bleeding on the ground, were rural, fallahin, poor, and they were cut out of the decision-making. Does that sound familiar?
I don't know, man, Hiba. Like, that sounds exactly what's happening currently.
The AHC, the Arab Higher Committee, tried to manage the general strike, and it issued statements, and it met with British officials, but they weren't in the fucking field. They weren't in the hills. They weren't the ones being hunted. So when the British outlawed the committee in 1937 and exiled most of its members, the revolt didn't fall apart because of that absence. It fell apart because of what filled the absence was disorganization, and it was division, and it was exploitation, right? So the Nashashibi faction, which had always been more comfortable with British power, started collaborating. They helped organize, like Petra was talking about, the peace bands. And it wasn't an ideological difference. It was an act of sabotage. It was Palestinians killing Palestinians under colonial command. And this is the part people kind of, I think, would they gloss over when they romanticize the revolt. And I think it's important to state that internal betrayal didn't happen in a vacuum. It was structurally enabled by a leadership that was more concerned with maintaining status than building a revolution, right?
Oh, 1,000%.
And the AHC couldn't hold the movement together because it was never designed to, right? It wasn't accountable to the fighters. It wasn't rooted in the communities carrying the revolt. And when it was gone, the gap it left behind wasn't tactical. It was intentional. And that fracture, it never really healed, right? Every Palestinian resistance formation since has inherited its fallout. Exile leadership, internal rivalry, and deep suspicion that those at the top are not only incapable of protecting the people, that they might be willing to sacrifice them.
You fucking ate.
It gave me goosebumps.
That was really good because it's so true. It's so true.
And the suspicion wasn't, like, it wasn't paranoia, right? It's precedent that was set. And the AHC, the Arab Higher Committee, operated like many national committees do. It claimed unity, right, while managing disunity. And there was an obvious class divide, and it wasn't incidental. It was the structure. The AHC's base was the Efendiya, right? Efendi, the wealthy landowners, city notables, families with economic interest in stability and not revolution. They didn't share the material conditions of the revolt, so they couldn't share its stakes. So they were willing to sell out for them, right? At the expense of them. And what the British understood and exploited was that political leadership without accountability is easy to neutralize. You exile it, you co-opt it, and you use it to divide. So that's exactly what happened. When the British outlawed the AHC and exiled its members, they didn't destroy the movement. They decapitated it in public, right? And they used its absence and filled the vacuum with collaborators. Like I mentioned, right, briefly, the Nashashibi faction, with longstanding ties to British administration, they stepped in and they armed the peace bands, as Petra talked about. And they weren't just traitors. They were elites who had always viewed the masses or the people as disposable, right? And the logic of collaboration, it wasn't ideological for them. I believe it was preservation of their class, of their faction, right? Of their tribe. Mm-hmm. And the consequences went far beyond the battlefield or the hills where we fought. When the peasants saw fighters executed while collaborators were negotiating land deals, it rewrote to us what leadership meant. Not protection, but it was abandonment. Like, and that psychic break, as we see, is still alive. And it shows up every time Palestinians are told to trust the process by people who will never be bombed, never be imprisoned, and never disappear. Right? It's why so many youth in the camps distrust the PLO. It's why Gaza rejects the legitimacy of the PA, and why quote-unquote unity always sounds like a threat when it comes from people who've never faced the consequences of failure. Because since 1936, Palestinians have learned that when leadership is uprooted or is unrooted, it becomes unaccountable. And when it's unaccountable, it becomes dangerous, right? Like, you see it in the political fragmentation today, right? In the obsession with factional control and the endless elections that never happen. In exile leaders who hold titles but not territory. And these aren't just modern problems. They're problems that stemmed, like I said, in 1936. The British didn't just suppress a revolt, right? It engineered a political landscape designed to keep Palestinians fractured. And the most effective part of that landscape wasn't guns. It was memory. Right? Like the memory of betrayal, memory of class divisions, memory of what happens when the people doing the fighting aren't the ones doing the talking. And that's what makes rebuilding so hard. And not just the loss of life, but the loss of political faith. The wound isn't just structural, it's emotional and it runs deep. And by 1939, the British called it pacified. What it meant was this. This is only according to specifically British numbers, by the way. British numbers. 5,000 Palestinians killed. Over 15,000 arrested. At least 100 executed publicly. Hundreds more disappeared. Arms confiscated. Villages destroyed. And leadership dismantled. Right? Yeah. The revolt didn't lose. It was bled out. And what the Palestinians did next, I think, matters. Because this could have been the end. Our, like, Fallujah moment. Are broken back, but instead it became a blueprint, right?
I just wanted to say, like, Walid al-Khalidi, right? We all know him. By one of the estimates he was looking at, 10% of all or of adult male Palestinians our population between 20 and 60 were killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled during this time. 10%. And, like, you can see the domino effect, because obviously this is before the Nakba. You know, when they say, why didn't the Palestinians fight? Like, where were y'all? Yeah, 10% of our men, our fighting aged men, were either killed, imprisoned in British jails, or they were kicked out already. I just, you know, I think it's very important.
Mm-hmm. So the revolt's end wasn't just a clean break, right? It was a slow erosion, I guess, of, like, trust, of unity, of faith in leadership. And when, like I keep talking about, when the AHC was dissolved and most leaders were exiled, what was left wasn't a political vacuum, it was a moral one. And people remembered who vanished and who collaborated and who negotiated instead of resisted. So, like, right, Petra, so Palestinians were executed by hanging, right, in, like, Aqqa prison. And most after summary military trials that lasted, guess how long these trials lasted for Palestinians?
How long?
Minutes.
Oh, okay.
There were, like, 12,000 people detained in concentration camps. Villages were demolished using naval mines. Orchards were uprooted and wells were poisoned, and more than £1 million in collective fines were imposed on Palestinian communities, astronomical sums designed to bankrupt resistance at its roots, right? And what this did was essentially, you know, bankrupts leads to homelessness, leads to displacement, right? And the numbers are just the surface. These are all only what we know due to British numbers. What the British accomplished was deeper. They didn't just defeat Palestinian resistance, they dismantled the social fabric that made it possible. And the British basically understood that crushing a revolt isn't about stopping bullets. It's about breaking the networks that produce them, right? About ensuring the conditions for organized resistance, and how making sure that these conditions can't, like, reconstitute themselves, right? And they hunted the village structures that supported the rebels, not just the rebels themselves. They targeted, like, muktars, religious leaders, merchants, teachers, anyone who could serve as a node in resistance networks. They understood that Palestinian society had to be atomized before it could be controlled. And they imposed, like, martial law, right? But, like, they didn't really call it. It was, like, everything but the name, right? Military courts replaced civilian courts, and officers superseded administrators. Like, being found in possession of a single bullet, it brought the death penalty. And it was only exclusively done to Palestinian Arabs. I told you about, like, entire villages were dynamited as collective punishment. For example, like, Mi'ar in the Galilee was completely obliterated and it was reduced to rubble. There were 22 out of 24 hour curfews.
Yeah. And then there was a village called Al Basa. There was a huge massacre there. So the village was shelled fully with machine guns. The houses were completely burnt. And then there were 20 men who survived. So what the Brits did, they decided to put them on a bus and then blow it up with the landmine. And any of the men who survived were then forced to bury the remaining people.
Oh my God, I had no idea.
This happened in 1938. It was a horrible massacre.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, wow. By 1939, right, Palestinian political society was in fragments. The field commanders were dead. Abdul Rahim al-Hajj Muhammad fell in British ambush in March. Abu Darra was captured and executed later that year. The urban leadership was exiled or underground. The village networks that had sustained the revolt were broken. But the deeper wound, I would argue, is what it did to the Palestinian political consciousness, right?
Yeah.
They didn't just suppress the revolt. They engineered a political landscape that was designed to keep Palestinians fractured, right? And the most effective part of the landscape wasn't guns, it was memory. the memory of betrayal and memory of the divisions between al-Fallahin or al-Afandi, the memory of what happens when the people doing the fighting aren't the ones doing the talking, like I said.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it goes into like the psychoanalytical dimension of colonial violence, right? It doesn't just kill bodies, it kills the trust. It kills the capacity to believe that collective action is possible without betrayal. It embeds suspicion so deeply into the political unconscious that resistance movements, they spend as much energy watching each other as they do fighting the colonizer.
A thousand percent, yeah.
Yeah, and the revolt taught Palestinians that their own elite would abandon them when things got dangerous, and that respectability would always win over the resistance when it comes to, like, power and consciousness or councils, right?
Mm-hmm.
That the people who called for revolt would flee when the bullets started flying, and they would always leave the Fallahin to face the British or the Empire alone. And that knowledge, I think that like that visceral body deep knowledge of abandonment became part of what it means to be Palestinian. Not just the Nakba, not just exile, but the understanding that in moments of crisis, you can't count on your own leadership.
Yeah.
That the price of resistance will always be paid by those who have the least to lose because they've already lost everything. And obviously, I'm not talking about like Muqawama is how we see it today, like people on the ground fighting, because I'm talking about the people who are represented by the people on the ground fighting, the PA, yeah. Right?
1,000%. And, you know, what some people may argue, right, what Yasser Arafat eventually became, and obviously, like, we'll do a extensive deep dive into that.
Mm-hmm.
but at the same time, right, so I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay, Saha.
I feel like on the flip side, right, like Palestinians seeing the Brits go super, super hard on them, you know, the night raids, bombing them and then like forcing them to bury the dead ones while simultaneously allowing the Jewish, you know, Haganah, Irgun, everyone else to flourish within this. They even like the Brits authorized at least 20,000 weapons to be carried by the Jewish police to force Palestinians not to revolt and to like quiet them down. They allowed them to have the special night squad again to conduct the night raids, to torture and to execute Palestinians. All of these things were happening while Palestinians who were on that land, who were fighting, and we all have to remember, right, the British mandate, I know it's very like stupid, but it was British mandate of Palestine. It was put into place for Palestinians to eventually rule over that land. But what we see is the Brits allowing the Jewish Zionist militias and just the people to overthrow Palestinians. They allowed them to have guns. They allowed them to torture mm-hmm. Palestinians. They silenced us. And all with, like, during all of this time, this is where, you know, like the Mossad was actually created. It wasn't called the Mossad back then, but this is like the footsteps of the Mossad.
Right.
And it all happened. And it was, I think it was called like the Shai, Shai back then. And eventually became, you know, Mossad. But it all happened under the British mandate. So while we were suppressed, silenced, killed, executed, bombed, the Jewish people were given bombs, guns, all of that to try and suppress us as well. And like for Palestinians to see that as, you know, like imagine it, that your people are becoming collaborators at the same time the people that you're fighting and these collaborators are seeing it. They're being given guns to kill you, to
exactly.
take your land.
Like, I don't know. I feel like that wound that we learned then, it never closed, right? Because it's like the deep bone level suspicion that the people claiming to represent us might actually be managing our defeat.
Mm.
Right? It became embedded. And I think that every Palestinian resistance formation has inherited that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you see that now, right? Like, you see it, like you were just talking about right now. You see it how, I don't know, like, I don't know, you get plenty of press releases from like leaders in exile that doesn't really fucking mean anything. Yeah. And you know, waiting 20 years for an election. And how it's not new problems, it's the same problems. And this is what, like, it makes rebuilding so hard. Not just like the loss of Palestinian fighters, but just like rebuilding broken institutions, right? Yeah. Trying to like reignite this political faith within the people. Right. And trying to like kind of like dispel that, hey guys, last time we rose up together, we were divided from within. Right. Yeah. And so what does that do to us? What does that do to our identity? It taught us to be cautious with our belief systems and to be so sharp with loyalty that we end up branding our own. Sometimes, most of the time, rightfully so, sometimes like wrongfully accused. And mm-hmm. we prioritize survival over symbols, and it's not a flaw within us, and it's not innate to Palestinian society. It's a response. It's what happens when you survive basically that and a revolt that failed, not because the people didn't rise up, it's because the leadership didn't hold. And the fallahin, the ones who fought, who bled, who buried their sons, they were never the ones negotiating with the British. They were the ones buried by British bombs while the leaders wrote letters of condemning, right? Of condemnation while in exile, right? The split between those who fight and those who speak, it became the defining trauma of our political psyche that still exists in this day in 2025. And you can still feel it. Right, I don't know. I just think we remember, and it's not just the violence, but like who walks away from this violence still clean, right?
100%.
I don't know. I think it's not historical. It's like I said, it's embodied. It's embodied with us now, right? And I think we also like this. While we have this memory that remembers that, we also have a memory that resists that, despite everything, despite the betrayals, and the. You know, the division between like the fallahin and the, you know, elite urban class, mm-hmm. us being disarmed, that Palestinians, we kept organizing. It wasn't out of optimism, it was out of necessity, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know, I feel like this is why it stays with us, right? Because if you think about it, Petra, this is why like some of us, like when we hear the word unity, we fucking flinch. Or
community.
Or why some of us would rather do it alone before being betrayed again. This is why there's always a new Palestinian faction instead of like combining them. There's always a new one popping up, right? And I don't know. It's when people say Palestinians are divided, they miss the fucking point. Like, so what do we do with this history, right? What do we do with the knowledge that the fracture defining Palestinian politics today was carved in 36 or in 39 and it never really healed? I think what's important for us is that we stop pretending it's ancient history, right? The betrayals of the Arab Higher Committee aren't irrelevant to the betrayals of today of the PA. And the same elite that abandoned the fallahin today, like in 1939, were the same elite that they became the same leadership that signed Oslo in 93.
Yeah.
Right? The same dynamic that privileged respectability over resistance became the dynamic that prioritizes international recognition over liberation. Right?
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be a cynic. I'm trying to establish and recognize a pattern. Right? I think what this revolt taught us is that Palestinian resistance has always been strongest when it emerged from below. From the orchards, right? From our land, from the villages, the people who had no choice but to fight because they had nowhere else to go. And every time that resistance gets channeled through traditional leadership structures, it gets betrayed and abandoned and co-opted. I don't know. I think it also teaches us something else, that this template has never been foolproof, that memory survives the suppression of it. And the capacity for resistance regenerates, and it always often does so in unexpected forms. And it also always does so when the colonizer thinks they've won in October 7th. And the revolt failed. Let's be clear about it. It failed militarily. It failed politically. It failed to prevent the Nakba. But the failure, isn't the same as defeat, and defeat isn't the same as erasure. The Fallahin of 36 are gone, but their children became the refugees of 48, and their grandchildren became the Fedayeen of the 60s, and their great grandchildren became the stone throwers of the Intifada, and the great grandchildren are the farmers as well as the fighters in Gaza right now, right? Yeah. And they became the poets and the prisoners. And each generation has had to learn the same lesson, right? That respectability won't save them. That appealing to the conscience of the colonizer is a dead end. Liberation requires a different kind of politics than the politics of accommodation, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some learned it quickly, right? And others, it took fucking decades. And there's some of us that we never really learned it at all. I don't know. I think that the Fallahin who rose in 1936 didn't have the benefit of history or historical precedent, right? They were literally improvising resistance against a colonial power with centuries of experience crushing rebellions, right? This is the British that we're talking about. They were fighting with the tools and ideas available to them in the context they inherited, right? Like, let me cook with this, right? We have their example, we have their failures and their achievements, and we know what happened, why they were defeated, how they were defeated, and by whom, the Brits and by us, right? But the question is, like, what do we do with this? Right? Do we use it to perfect the politics of martyrdom, or do we romanticize suffering, or do we write about it and turn it into a poem, or do we turn resistance into performance, right? Do we sit there and be cynical and like basically say, well, or be like nihilistic and say, oh, see, resistance does nothing, and you know, nothing really changes, and our, you know, struggle is futile, and we might as well just like, you know, we might as well just give up and just give them what they want. Or do we use it to sharpen our analysis, right? To understand how colonialism adapts and how betrayal operates. Do we use it as to build something that can outlast the next suppression? Build something that survives the next time that we get betrayed, right?
Mm-hmm.
The revolt obviously is over, and the fracture it revealed remains. But fracture can be sites of weakness, or they could be sites of transformation. And the choice is ours. The lesson is clear, and the work continues. Because in the end, the most radical thing the revolt taught us wasn't how to fight the colonizer. It was how to fight the idea that we have no choice but to accept the terms of our own oppression. And that refusal, that simple, stubborn refusal, is what survives when everything else is crushed. And that refusal is the reason why we're still here. So, yeah.
Cucked.
I'm freaking love you.
No, that was really good.
Hopefully I wrapped it up in a pretty bow.
No, that was amazing. So this episode is part of the series for resistance. I want people to understand we're not only going to be giving you like, oh, here's a Palestinian resistance group, here's the date.
Yeah,
here's
like, the lecture, like a fucking lecture. You guys can go find lectures everywhere else.
Like go Wikipedia that or something. We're going to talk about why these like resistance group emerged, how it mirrors exactly like what Hiba was saying with what we currently see. And what you said. See. No, because you freaking ate, bro. I love your little analysis at the end, always. But yeah, so this is, you know, I'm so excited for this series. Mm-hmm. But that wraps it up for today's episode. And that means we will be commemorating another martyr with Humanize Gaza. So Humanize Gaza is a project to make sure our people in Palestine, whether it's the West Bank or Gaza, our people in Lebanon, our people in Yemen who have been martyred for our cause will never be forgotten. You can always find more stories, more martyr stories, if you head to the website humanizegaza.org. You can always subscribe to the newsletter as well. Today's martyr, his name is Jihad Al-Hajj. He was martyred December 7th of 2023. Jihad Al-Hajj Ahmad was a player for the Palestinian national football team, and he was always also a captain and one of the most prominent sport figures in the Gaza Strip. He was a determined man who managed to educate his four children in the field of general medicine despite his limited personal income. His top priority in life was to please Allah, and he never missed any prayer in the mosque, even during the times of the genocide, when hardly anyone would go to the mosque for the Fajr prayer. He would leave his house before the first call, and when asked about why he would do this, he would always say that if the muaddan, or the person who calls the prayer, didn't show up, he would perform the call to prayer himself and wake people up for prayer. Yeah, mashallah. He was an extremely righteous person, a preserving man, and a true hero in every sense of the word. He lived his whole entire life in service of his country, religion, and to anyone who knew him. He was martyred on December 7th of 2023, along with his wife and his daughter, Dr. Shahad Jihad Al-Hajj Ahmad. You can always search him up. He was a captain of the football team in Gaza. He trained, you know, the men that we, unfortunately, Palestine didn't make it to the World Cup series, but they made it really, really close. He was their captain. So, Allah yirhamo, Allah yirham kul shuhada. And I also wanted to mention, like, with everything going on, like, W Iran and everything, but always, I want people to understand that when Israel is being bombed or is throwing missiles at Iran, Gaza usually gets thrown to the side. Please make sure to continue. It's
on purpose.
Yeah, 100%. Please make sure to continue searching for the news of Gaza. They're still being genocided. It's actually really, really bad. I saw a horrible video yesterday. The little kid, and just like the fire, like at night was
crazy. I think over 500 Palestinians have died the last 4 days.
Yeah, and it's because it's because everyone is talking about Iran, which we have Shuhada in Iran too, and they should be talked about, but please don't forget Gaza. This is like prime time for Israel to literally obliterate them.
Allah yirhamun, Allah yirham kal amwatkum.
Amen.
And we'll see you guys next week. Thank you guys for listening.
Thank you guys. Bye.
Bye.